What do you eat and drink when it's absurdly hot? And do we even remember how to behave in a restaurant? That's coming up on KUOW's The Record. Stay tuned. I'm Bill Radke. When it is this hot, maybe 100 degrees on the west side of the state this weekend, we can't just think of iced tea and swimming pools. We also got to think climate change and wildfires and smoke. How is Washington State preparing for yet another potentially catastrophic wildfire season? Welcome back to the show, State Public Lands Commissioner Hillary Franz.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk with you again. What effect does this heat have on our public lands?
Significant. We are experiencing here in Washington State worst drought actually in state history. And to date, we've already responded to almost 500 fires, frankly, on both sides of Cascade. That's almost double the five-year average of the number of fires by this point in the year. And I know everyone's remembering last year, 2020, horrific fire season, 820,000 acres burned. We are already up 52% from this time in 2020. So this is very concerning fact.
How can we have our worst drought when we had a decent snow season?
Well, you know, this is one of those things where often we remember that snow. We think we're in great straits for the rest of the year. But the fact is, even when we have a great snow season, if our warmer, hotter temperatures come earlier in the year and they stay for long, prolonged periods, the landscape gets very, very dry. And as we know, if you have a dry landscape, whether it's our grass or whether it's our forest lands, that quickly becomes very tender, almost like kindling in a fireplace.
Yeah. So we have this kind of drought and now this kind of heat, 109 in Spokane next Tuesday, 100 plus in Spokane all week, just to pick an example. Does that guarantee a catastrophic fire season, or there are more factors involved?
Well, there's more factors involved. You know, last year we started with a pretty challenging early fire season, but then we got lucky. I remember we were being sort of cautiously optimistic when July we saw cooler temperatures. We saw even some moisture that we had not expected or isn't typical in July. And we were doing pretty good, frankly, until, as we all remember, those horrific Labor Day firestorms. So while right now we have the significant drought that is playing out and like I said, worst in our state history, if we got some cooler temperatures and some moisture, we would be doing better. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that on the horizon. And that's what's so alarming, is that we're in very bad straits right now today, and we are predicting it will continue well into the typical fire season.
What has caused the fires that we've had? We've had more than, you know, hundreds of fires just so far already this year. What's mainly causing them?
Yeah, so 496 fires so far this year. And what we're seeing, again, most of our fires are human-caused. We continue to have 80% of our fires caused by humans. Majority of the fires we're seeing this year plays out just like last year, is debris pile burns. People are at home still because of COVID. They're getting out in their yard. They're doing their yard work. And unfortunately, they're lighting those debris piles on fire. So that's one of the most prevalent fires starts that we see. We also know we're headed into our holidays, you know, holidays coming up here, July 4th, more and more people going out on our public lands, which is wonderful, but it also creates significant concern if they are leaving campfires unattended. If they're out parking their car on dry grass, it creates a spark of any kind. We need everybody to be aware that it's very easy for a fire to start with just simple human activity and to try to be one less spark out on our landscape.
Are campfires already banned?
Yes. Yeah. In certain areas where we have the ability to do it, but it's not throughout the state. It's really based on a jurisdictional
authority. What about those debris pile fires? Is that legal?
Yes, and again, in some places where it's allowed, but in some places it isn't, where we put in burn bans. We are going to be extremely cautious here. We put in burn bans very, very early, but these burn bans do not apply across the board.
What about fireworks? Should we make fireworks illegal? I mean, of course, they are in some places, have been up for a long time, but with the continued heat, climate change, drought, fires, smoke? Is it time to ban fireworks?
This is a constant question that is out there, and these decisions are largely at the local jurisdictional level. I know as a former city council member, we actually limited the use of fireworks to a set time period so that it would reduce the amount of fire risk. I think it's something that when you look at the landscape that we have currently in drought-like conditions, local jurisdictions should be looking at questioning whether we are having fireworks at certain times of the year. Now, it may mean that not every year should they be banning fireworks, but in certain situations like this, similar to how we implement burn bans based on the conditions of the landscape, it should be being considered. Right now, I think it should be top of mind that every single resident of Washington State should be thinking about what they can do to prevent these wildfires. Too often, we think that these catastrophic wildfires like we saw last year and we saw up and down the West Coast is something that we can't stop, that it's out of our control. The fact is, it is very much in every single person's ability to prevent them. And right now, given the state of our drought, given the fact that the majority of Western states are also in an unprecedented historical drought, 90% of the Western U.S. experiencing these drought conditions, the worst we've seen in the entire history of the U.S. drought monitor. And that every time any state, you know, we have multiple states fighting for wildfire resources, we all come up short. And the people that are most at risk are those who are living in wildland urban interface. And of course, our first responders, our firefighters who are putting their lives on the line. I need all citizens, similar to how we've asked all citizens, step up and protect themselves from global deadly pandemic and protect their neighbors, protect their friends, protect their community by taking actions to prevent the spread of COVID. We need every single resident of Washington State doing the same thing to prevent the spread of these wildfires.
Let's talk more about prevention, about firefighters, about, as you said, coming up short on resources. This is Washington State Public Lands Commissioner Hillary Franz. Washington State's legislature recently put $125 million over 2 years toward wildfire response and prevention. Where will that added money go toward?
Yeah, so first, this is, as you've heard me say before, this is transformative historical investment. We have been ringing the alarm bell for the last 4 years, with five of the last 6 years being catastrophic fire season, with almost 2.5 million acres burning in that same period in Washington State. We've been saying we need to become more dependent on ourselves and invest in air resources, firefighters, invest in the equipment we need to get on those fires quickly, contain them, and put them out. And we also need to be proactive investing in restoring the health of our forests, because our forests can naturally fight fires when they're healthy, and help our communities, the 2 million plus homes that are at risk right now today, and that number is growing, to be more resilient in the face of fire. We are fortunate this last year we finally secured the critical, much-needed funding from our legislature, $500 million over the next 8 years. We will now be able to increase firefighters from 60 to 160, add increased air resources to our 11 rotors, many which fought in the Vietnam War, and increase those resources at our local fire district level, our local firefighters who are on the front lines throughout our state. That right now, unfortunately, that money we will not be able to be getting until the end of July, and we will be immediately processing that to purchase new air resources and to train those 100 new firefighters and get the grants down to the local fire district level. Unfortunately, that takes time, and as a result, much of our wildfire funding that we secure from the legislature, we will not see this year. We will be seeing it next year in the 2022 fire season.
But the legislature's allocated that money, and we're starting fire season right now. Why can't they send it to you earlier?
Well, the way it works is the money doesn't become available until the end of July through the budgetary appropriation. Now, that being said, remember what we have the ability to do, because the way we fight fires is it goes in is charged to the emergency account. It's our wildfire suppression. So we are able to go and out and contract for air resources. We are able to go and we've trained our seasonal firefighters, just as we do every single year. And this year, we've been increasing the number of air resources significantly as best we can, although we're competing with other states for those resources, as you are well aware of. So we've been doing everything to get those ready to go, and those get then charged in as we respond to these fires.
You said that money is going to take us from 60 firefighters to 160. Washington State also employs hundreds of prison inmates as firefighters. Do they volunteer to do that, if volunteer is the right word for an inmate? How does that work?
Yeah, so they choose to sign up for that role, and they are paid to do the firefighting. And so it's a choice. We are really thrilled again by House Bill 1168 that passed this last year with that significant investment in our firefighting resources, and because there is a provision in there that now will pay them at minimum wage, which is, you know, a significant increase from what they were being paid for, which rightfully so, given these are men and women who are putting their lives on the line every day for us.
So the incarcerated firefighters will make $15 an hour?
Yes. So I'll have to get the exact amount, but yes, it's a minimum wage provision.
That is significant, since last year, at least Crosscut reported that our state was paying less than a dollar an hour.
It's huge. It was paying a little more than a dollar an hour. It obviously was not appropriate. I mean, again, this is life-threatening work. And very, very arduous and challenging. And so this is, you know, another significant benefit of passing House Bill 1168. There are so many parts of that bill that are going to create great opportunities for the state of Washington to finally be able to have the resources it needs to fight these fires and also be proactive in the forest health work. And in addition to that, we will now be able to pay what we rightfully should be paying our camp crews, as well as the fact there's a whole workforce development piece. One of the things we're hearing is nationally, as we see many of our western states that are facing the significant drought and therefore also at significant risk for wildfires, is we are seeing a challenge in getting enough people coming forward, not necessarily here in Washington State, but in other states to fight these fires. Obviously, last year, we can all remember during the Labor Day firestorm where 600,000 acres burned in 72 hours. Mm-hmm. We remember the skeleton crews that we had on the ground. And Washington wasn't alone in that. We were fighting for the resources we need on the ground, those hand crews that get in and they dig that containment line. They help contain that fire and mop it up and put it out, and they move to the next one. And many of them were having to do 96-hour shift because we had so few resources. My concern is, you know, Washington State, we're in for a really challenging fire season. We're not the only state in for a challenging fire season. And as many of the other states are also facing that, our resources, their resources will be stretched thin. The other important piece to know is when our season starts earlier, like it is again this year, and it goes for longer, our firefighters get very exhausted. The more exhausted they get, the more at risk they are for being tired and for injuries. And again, we're not alone as we face this challenging fire season.
Do firefighters get hazard pay like pandemic era essential when it's 100 plus in Eastern Washington?
I don't believe so. I can get more information on that. I don't believe so.
Okay. Not that it's not an arduous job all the time, but, you know, this is some.
It is a pretty arduous job all the time, but especially, you know, there are definitely periods where it's down. But the fact is, when you look at the last few fire seasons, like 2018, 2020, 2015, and what's likely this year, there is very little downtime. They're moving from one fire to the next.
Have you or will you shut down state lands because of fire danger?
We have not. We first operate from the burn ban approach and really sort of limiting the ability of fire on the landscape at all. we can and will look at that if we start to see some significant challenges. You know, we obviously, you will remember that last year during COVID that we had to shut down our public lands as we tried to prevent the spread of the global deadly pandemic. It was something, it was one very hard thing to do, as we know more and more people were escaping out to our public lands for that mental, physical, and emotional health that in a very trying time. You know, we're urging people to recreate responsibly, that we don't want to take that opportunity that of enjoying our landscape, especially in some of the most beautiful times of our year, to enjoy that landscape. And we're urging people to really take responsibility for themselves and protect the landscape, protect their community, protect themselves, and protect our firefighters, because right now it's going to be a bad year.
Finally, Commissioner Franz, we keep getting the worst air quality in the world because of wildfire smoke. And sometimes cities, including Seattle, don't have resources to protect everybody. What's being done statewide, and what can be done to help people who deal with the toxic air quality from fires?
Yes, we keep getting hit. You're right. 2018, 2020, worst air quality in the world, Spokane to Seattle. Not all of it being fires that were here in Washington State. We get California, mm-hmm. Oregon,
right.
Canada. You know, I think right now, most important steps are largely happening at the local community level of making sure that community spaces that have the proper air filtration are available to people, and so they can go there if they don't have it within their own home. I know that the city of Seattle has taken steps in the past to provide that kind of filtration services within apartments and other facilities. And I think it's something that more and more, as we see year after year, that wildfire season is no longer an anomaly. It is the new reality that we're going to have local and state government stepping into to find ways to actually ensure the health of our air quality within buildings.
Yeah, it's become so consistent, but yet so unpredictable in any particular place that I wondered if it was going to fall more under your job. Okay, well, more on that to come. We're hoping, you know, we're hoping for the best for our public lands across the West. This is Washington State's Public Lands Commissioner Hillary Franz talking about wildfire danger. Thank you, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Everyone be safe this summer. Thanks.
Yeah, you too, Commissioner Franz. This is The Record on KUOW. We're going to come right back and talk about what you eat and drink when it's super hot. And where do you go? We've got some ideas for you with the Seattle Times' Bethany Jean Clement in a moment. As hot as it's going to be this weekend, what are we going to eat and drink and where and how? Why are we going to just dine as if it weren't 100 degrees? We brought in Bethany Jean Clement from the Seattle Times, a food writer there, who we always enjoy talking to. Bethany, you put together a list of restaurants you're excited about and also some etiquette tips on how to behave as if we've forgotten. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Yeah, what kind of food? Yes, go ahead.
I just am preparing to cower in front of a fan and rock back and forth and try not to think about climate change too much. And, I've got some ideas of stuff to eat and drink that might help get us through the weekend and, I guess, beyond.
Yeah. After we take a break from the whimpering, what kind of food are you eating in this weather, Bethany Jean?
Here in Seattle, the Seattle area, we're really lucky to have tons and tons of banh mi, the Vietnamese deli sandwiches. I think those really make perfect hot weather eating. Obviously, a sandwich is great in the summertime. Banh mi have those really airy, light baguettes, and it's personal size. It's got a little bit of spice to it, and they're just really easy to eat and grab from a deli in Little Saigon, maybe, or your local Vietnamese place if they make them. Head to the lake. They get crumbs all over you, so they're perfect for eating outside.
Yeah. I like sandwiches outside because I'm often not at a table when I'm outside. I might be just with my lap and the paper towel that's blowing around or something. So finger food that's not too falling apart is good stuff.
Yes. Another thing that's sort of counterintuitive is hot and spicy soup. It was 93 degrees a couple weeks ago one day, which I think in a few days we'll be looking back on longingly. And yeah. I went to my neighborhood Thai spot, Manao, on Capitol Hill. They are wonderful. Two wonderful women run it. And I had their spicy rice noodle soup sitting outside at a table across from the fire station. So there's the audio of the fire truck screaming out every so often. Mm-hmm. And you do start to lightly glow a little bit from the yes. spice. And it really cools you down. And if you pair it with a big Thai iced coffee or Thai iced tea, which are sweetened with the condensed milk, mm-hmm. It's just a really, it's a kind of a perfect lunch or supper. And everybody's yeah. Thai place, local favorite Thai place, should have some kind of nice spicy soup.
That's a good call. Make yourself sweat and cool yourself off while you're enjoying a good meal.
Indeed.
Very nice.
I'm also a huge proponent of popsicles for everyone. Mm-hmm. Yay for the kids. You can make or buy ones with real fruit juice, or, you know, I don't think we should judge anyone who wants like the red, white, and blue bomb pop. Mm-hmm. And for the grown-ups, pro tip, it's really wonderful to take a popsicle and swizzle it in a glass of cold champagne or Cremant or Prosecco or Vino Verde, any kind of white wine with a sparkle to it. And the bubbles kind of cling to the popsicle melts in it a little bit. It's magical. You will feel better.
I've never done that, never thought of it. You got to match your flavors right, though.
I mean, your white wine can go with pretty much whatever you want. Your bubbles, they play easy with everything. I like pineapple for sort of like a tropical meets France vibe.
Yeah, this is good. What else about when you're not just at a restaurant, but you're cooking or grilling or mixing? What are some of your favorite quintessential summer ingredients?
Well, I mean, grilling vegetables, so many vegetables love to go on the grill, and you don't want to really be cooking in the kitchen. There may still be the end of Washington asparagus season out there right now. Asparagus loves a little olive oil, salt and pepper, go on the grill. Different fruits. Peaches aren't in season yet, but many fruits, pineapple, you know, treat yourself. It came from far away, but it's hot out. And you can throw pineapple on the grill. It's delicious. Pizza, if you want to make some homemade pizza and don't want to heat up your kitchen, you can throw your pizza stone or pan on the grill and turn it up as high as it'll go. Get it really blazing hot and then make your pizza in there. It'll work great.
I normally like grilling, heating up my kitchen, but man, if it's going to be 100 and I'm standing over the flames, I don't know, that trade-off might start to shift for me. But I do love the grilling. Are the peaches are not in season? If we get a peach locally, is it not local yet?
Not yet. That'll be a little bit later in the summer.
Okay. I do like the firm peaches for holding up to a flame. We're talking with Bethany Jean Clement, who writes at the Seattle Times, food writer there. And we're talking now, what about some of your favorite, first of all, did you grow up someplace hotter than Seattle? I'm curious.
No, I grew up here. Okay. And so like all of us who did, when it gets above approximately 74 degrees, we just crumple. It's
yes.
too much for us. So it's going to be a hard weekend.
Yep.
Go to the lake and throw yourself in if you can.
Yeah, that's why I asked. I've been here a long time too, so the rocking back and forth and whimpering is familiar. What about some of your favorite Seattle summer restaurants, Bethany?
I love to go to my longtime favorites, Le Pichet downtown and its sibling Cafe Press, which is sort of lodged between Capitol Hill and First Hill. They make beautiful, simple French food, including an amazing green salad. I know that sounds perhaps like a contradiction in terms, but it has hazelnuts on it and the lettuce is perfect and crisp. It's cooling. it's wonderful with a glass of rosé. They also make delicious baguette sandwiches. They have a sardine sandwich with also has nice crisp lettuce and lots of mayonnaise. It's delicious. Mm. And and they also, in case people are still feeling nervous about dining in, they have to-go menus at both of their spots too. And I have taken the dream of a green salad home, and it was just as wonderful. So,
You wrote about some of the places you're looking forward to. There's a Polynesian-themed place opening up, which is pretty incredible timing.
Oh, yeah, that will be, it's neighboring the bar on Capitol Hill called Rumba.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, I think it's actually lodged inside. I haven't seen it yet. It's a tiki bar inside an existing bar, and I believe they have air conditioning. I'm not completely sure whether it's open yet or not, but it's worth finding out, I would say. Definitely.
You say that eating out at a restaurant now is not just an indulgence. It's the right thing to do. You want us to get out.
I want people to get out within their comfort level. I want people to get out if they're vaccinated. If they're not vaccinated, they shouldn't be in enclosed spaces with other people, and they should get vaccinated. My personal opinion. But yes, if you're comfortable going back out, it's a great way to show your support. I mean, takeout still is wonderful as well. But if you're ready, and it seems like a lot of people are, and then we will have an announcement from the governor next Wednesday, which it's widely anticipated things will be opening back up. If you're ready, restaurants here are ready for you, and you know they would love to see you.
Yeah. Speaking of takeout, you wrote about etiquette. Is it wrong to order takeout when it's pushing 100 degrees and someone's got to deliver that?
No. The best thing to do with takeout is, if you can manage it, go pick it up yourself. If you've got a car with AC, order online, hop in the car, go grab it. That way they don't have to pay a fee to a third-party delivery vendor. Some places have their own delivery, but those are sort of few and far between. The city of Seattle still has a cap on those delivery fees, unlike the rest of the state, which just rescinded them, rescinded the cap. The cap is good because more money goes to the restaurants and hopefully to the drivers. And in terms of having food delivered, I think most places would say, well, yeah, please do it. That's still money in the driver's pockets and money in the restaurant's pockets.
Yeah. What about the etiquette of... You mentioned vaccination. What about masks? Do you wear your mask whenever you're not chewing? Do you put your mask on when your server approaches?
You know, it's wildly different at different places out there. I've recently started dining in, and it just depends on the protocol of the individual restaurant, which is something you really want to respect. You want to ascertain it as soon as you get there. They may have a sign about their policy. You should wear your mask while you're going in. It's generally expected that you would wear your mask when you're not at the table. And then your server can tell you what's going on with the particular place that you happen to be. And it sounds like it might be an awkward conversation. It is a little awkward if your server remains masked, which most of them do, out of an abundance of caution, and they don't know whether non-vaccinated people might be coming in.
Yep.
So I think expressing, you know, I'm so glad you're here. Sorry you still have to wear a mask. We are all vaccinated, and we're just really happy to be back here. I think that goes a long way towards easing any awkwardness.
Yeah. Seattle Times food writer Bethany Jean Clement, you also say to remember that at restaurants, this is a quote from you, things may be different or even a little off the rails. Why is that?
Well, places are, as they're trying to reopen again and have more seating, they are having to make some hiring decisions faced with a tough labor market, which is tough across the board and was in Seattle even before the pandemic. And they just starting up again is not a simple thing. It takes time to get up to speed, to train new people. Menus may be smaller, which is understandable. The kitchen may be short-staffed. They aren't going to be making the most elaborate things necessarily. Your menu may still be on your phone, not on paper. And if things go a little bit wrong, it's really important to remember it's not your server's fault. It's just things are tough out there. And to be understanding of the fact that a place might be having a little bit of a hard time and extend human sympathy instead of getting cranky and going on Yelp about it is really, really important right now.
Yeah. I forgot to mention that you, in a bunch of restaurants you wrote about, I was glad to see you mention Canlis, which is a hot ticket right now. I feel like they've been a pandemic hero. Remind us what's going on at Canlis.
Oh, they've done all kinds of really creative, interesting things throughout the pandemic. They had a drive-in movie theater with Canlis-made burgers and fries that I went to, which was really fun. I believe we watched Groundhog Day.
The perfect
pandemic movie.
Yeah,
They've been making bagels in their parking lot, all kinds of stuff. And during the pandemic, their former chef has departed. He's looking to open a place actually in White Center, interestingly. And they have a brand new chef, and she seems incredibly skilled and talented. And she's the first female chef that they've ever had, which is amazing. And she came with her partner, who is also going to be doing some research work for Canlis, and it's going to be very hard to get a reservation there for quite some time, but it's exciting.
Yeah, good for them. May it be hard for me to get into Canlis all summer long. Bethany Jean Clement, anything else to leave us with? This show is going to be off the air for the 4th of July. We're going to kind of retool and come back strong after the summer. So any ideas about the 4th, I don't know, picnicking, eating out, what do you have to leave us with?
We do have a story up with 11 picnics to go from Great Seattle Chefs, which you can find on seattletimes.com. That's a great resource for 4th of July if you don't want to cook and for the rest of the summer. Just sort of on the flip side of Canlis getting a new chef, I would like to mention that Jackson's Catfish Corner is reopened in the Central District. Storied, beloved Catfish Corner had moved around a few times and is back and looks to be better than ever and seems like a great place to pick up a summertime picnic.
It was over by Garfield when I was in college, and I was there this weekend at the opening, 23rd and Jackson, lines out the door
cool.
all day. Yeah. Good
Great.
Call. Yeah, Catfish
yeah.
Corner, and just enjoy it more than we could possibly get to. But I love getting to check in with you, especially I'm going to remember the make myself glow with chili peppers and cool off, Bethany Jean Clement. Good call. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here. Stay cool.
Stay cool. Seattle Times food writer Bethany Jean Clement. We're going to talk about something else that's hot right now, and that is the private trade in fossils when we return to the record. Stay tuned. Okay, there's a market for just about anything, but you know what's hot right now is fossils. In the past year, a T-Rex tooth sold for $11,000, a butterfly preserved in an amber resin sold for $38,000. Private collectors crave bones like fine art, bones of the new Picasso. But all this private collection poses some challenges to the paleontologist community. My guest is Christian Sidor, a paleontologist at the Burke Museum. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Why are fossils such a must-have?
Oh boy, that's a tough question. I mean, I think it's probably boils down to, people interested in really exceptional rare things, and among the rare things in the world, dinosaurs and other fossils are at the top of the list, I guess.
True. Is it trendy to have an entire T-Rex standing in your show-off room under your extremely vaulted ceiling?
Well, I have to imagine there are not many rooms that can handle that,
No.
but clearly there's a market for it because, just a little while ago, a T-Rex skull and skeleton, the whole skeleton, sold for almost $32 million to a private collector. So they must have a place to put it, I suppose.
Not saying it's Jeff Bezos, but not saying it's not. We don't know. How do you get these fossils?
Well, I mean, most of the fossils that we hear about, the T-Rexes, the Triceratops, those things are all from North America, and there are a lot of commercial collectors out there these days. I mean, like you mentioned, dinosaurs are hot, fossil sales are hot, and there's a huge economic incentive for people to go out and look for them on private land, and all of that is totally legal.
For people to look on their own land, like first of all, I picture dinosaurs being in the West. So you're saying people are scouring their private land looking for fossils they can sell?
Yeah, so most of the fossils, that are of general interest, I suppose, to the public and the consumers out there are probably the big charismatic dinosaurs, right?
Yeah.
Mostly from the Cretaceous, and those rocks are best known from places like Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, sort of that portion of the western interior. And those rocks are outcropping. If you happen to own those lands, either you can go look for them or you can, charge a fee for a commercial outfit to come and look for those fossils on your land, and probably make some agreement on sharing whatever they get for it at auction.
And so all this is legal. If a fossil's on your property, you own it.
Absolutely. That's what our culture, our government has decided is the way to go. We've carved out exceptions for things like archaeological sites, right? You're not allowed to just take whatever archaeological site is on your land that has special laws governing it. You're not able to take, for example, sometimes the water rights. If the water, happens on your land, you can't take all of that water. There may be other laws related to the flow of that water off of your land. But fossils are treated as private property. And so if it's on your land, it belongs to you.
Why? What's the difference between a fossil and an archaeological site?
Well, I imagine it's the relationship to human ancestry, and ancestors that have been here in the not too too distant past, compared to fossils, which are, on the order of millions to hundreds of million years old, and don't have a direct relationship to cultures that exist today.
Okay. We're talking with from the Burke Museum paleontologist Christian Sedor. Do you own any fossils?
No, I don't. Paleontologists, like professional paleontologists like myself, belong to societies, and so I belong to the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. And as a professional paleontologist, we have an ethics statement, and part of that is that fossils should be reposited in public museums. And so a privately held fossil goes against that ethics statement. So it's not to say that the society condones or sorry, I shouldn't say condones. Well, it doesn't condone the sale of fossils, but as long as those fossils are held in the public trust, then it's okay. We're talking about how much fossils can actually cost. Museums have basically been priced out of the market, but it would be totally legal or totally ethical for my Burke Museum to purchase a fossil because then it's available to the public. That's very different from a private person buying that fossil, me as a private person buying that fossil and holding it in my office or holding it in my at my house where it's not available to the public.
Is it ethical for a museum to take and have fossils from other countries where they were found?
Well, again, that depends on the laws of the country. So there have been definitely some notable cases in the last few years of fossils being illegally exported. And I can think of, off the top of my head, I can think of Brazil as a major one where the laws strictly state that you can't export fossils, vertebrate fossils from Brazil, and they've wound up in museums in other countries. China, Myanmar also, and as well Mexico. Are a few cases that have just come up in the last few years where these fossils have been illegally exported, brought to another museum potentially, or brought to a private, private owner in some other country. And then those are the ones that at least I can tell you about because they've tried to publish on them in the literature. There are just so many fossils, however, that we'll never know of that, go into private hands, and then the research community never hears about them, or only hears about them through some, shadowy photo that someone has of this spectacular something or other that will never see the light of day scientifically.
Does this fossil trade pose any problems to your work at the Burke Museum?
Well, like I said, anytime we're competing with private individuals who have that kind of dollar possibility, that kind of purchasing power, natural history museums as nonprofits, these days just can't compete, barring having people who are affiliated with the museum or donors to the museum, supporters of the museum who will go out and purchase something and then donate it to the museum. We're out of luck. Personally, myself, my research, I work at Petrified Forest National Park in Arizona, so I'm working on government property already. Work in Antarctica, which has its own set of laws and rules that go along with it, but of course, there's not really too much fossil tourism going on down there. And then I work in several places in Africa, and we've got agreements that all of those fossils that we collect eventually go back to those home countries.
Are there a lot of fossils in Antarctica? Do you
Uh,
have dinosaurs in Antarctica?
yeah, there are there are a handful of dinosaurs from Antarctica. They all come from one major locality in the central Trans-Antarctic Mountains at about, I think my recollection is that it's at about 9,000 feet. So you're up doing excavations in sub-freezing temperatures. But I work on the Triassic period down there, and that's at least at lower elevations, but it's about 250 million years old, 245 million years old, predating dinosaurs.
Pre-dinosaurs. Okay. So when you're a paleontologist, I imagine you loving these fossils. Do you wish you could own them? Is that hard for you not to have fossils in your den?
Oh, at home, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, of course, because I think for people to think that, shark teeth, for example, are really cool to have, megalodon tooth or something like that. But the way that the laws in the United States are set up, it's kind of strange. So invertebrate fossils, and now I'm talking about fossils from public lands, right? So say you're out and you're on either Bureau of Land Management land or maybe National Forest land or something like that. You can collect invertebrates like shells or trilobites or things like that. Well, I think the law says to a reasonable extent without a permit, and that's fine. Same thing with fossil plants. But fossil vertebrates, right, backboned animals, you actually need a permit for collecting on public lands. And that's a pretty coarse distinction, right? It's basically saying that all invertebrates are created equal, all plants are created equal, but vertebrates have some special status. But shark teeth are among the most common fossils you can find in the fossil record, because sharks basically, are conveyor belt of making teeth. They make teeth throughout their entire life. They drop teeth to the ocean floor their entire life, and so there's millions and millions of fossil shark teeth, and so they shouldn't actually, in my opinion, have the same restrictions placed on them that something that is, very rare or something that is new to science should, whether it's an invertebrate or a plant or a vertebrate.
I think I hear you saying you wish you could own shark teeth, and you
Well,
can't.
there's plenty. Yeah, around here, we actually we just collected a fossil shark tooth, a big sort of megalodon type shark tooth, recently this year. So they are around, but they're pretty
Okay.
rare in the Pacific Northwest.
What can we do about this problem, this private dino fossil trade? What can we do?
I don't know. I mean, I think this has been generated. I was trying to think about this, before I came on. I have to imagine that some of this fossil trade and the interest generally in dinosaurs probably stems from the original Jurassic Park movie coming up, right? And people, it just got brought back into the public sphere. And then, you know, the sale of Sue to the T-Rex, to Sue the T-Rex, was sold to the Field Museum in Chicago in the late 90s, and that at the time was thought to be an outrageous amount of money, so something like $9 million or something like that. And now, you know, however many years later, 20 something years later, another T-Rex for almost $32 million. So I think dinosaurs are perennially exciting to people, but they become sort of even more and more of interest because they're just sort of culturally around these days. People think about them, the Jurassic Park franchise movies, other things like that. But I suppose, you know, being at a university museum, the big thing that I would advocate is for education, right? People should know that if fossils go into private hands, the scientists aren't going to see them, but more importantly, maybe the public's not going to see them. They're going to be in someone's big vaulted ceiling. And at some point in the future, someone's probably going to get bored of that, decide they want something else in that big space. And then who knows what happens to the fossil at that point.
Yeah. So is that why you're on the show today? You're publicly educating us?
I suppose so. I mean, I've got plenty of opinions on this stuff. We could go into a long, long discussion. I mean, I think most of this eventually boils down to property rights in the United States. The way that we view private property as sort of above a lot of other things, we value private property above a lot of other things in the United States. And until that changes, I don't think any of the downstream effects of that are going to change. And one of those, unfortunately, is the commercial sale of fossils. Because fossils are sort of, you know, world heritage items. If you think about it, T-Rex, even though, like I said, it's only from some certain places in the Western United States, it's a global thing. Everyone, and you ask anyone in the world, you know, most people in the world, and they know T-Rex, so they know Triceratops. But it's really it's a Montana, Wyoming, you know, Southern Alberta kind of fossil.
Paleontologist at the Burke travels to, I think you said, Arizona, Africa, Antarctica, and also a professor of biology, University of Washington. Christian Sedor, fascinating. Thanks a lot for visiting with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to The Record today on KUOW. Bill Radke here. Today's the final show before The Record goes on break for the summer. While we're gone, you will get to hear another great NPR program, WBUR and NPR's On Point. And here with the preview is the host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Good to talk with you, Meghna.
Hey, Bill, it's great to talk to you. And by the way, I just want to say congratulations for having done such a great run on The Record for so long.
Thank you. Very kind of you. Meghna, for anybody who hasn't heard your show On Point before, what are we going to hear at noon?
Well, what we're going to hear is what we've been trying to do on the show is, like, we're living in a world of big complexity. And so every day we pick a topic, and actually frequently a place in the United States, where we go deep and talk to people in that location and try to match their lived experience with some expertise on how to understand how the news is having an impact on them. Mm-hmm. And so that's really kind of the thrust of the show. It's different than what the show used to be. It used to be a call-in show, but as a native Pacific Northwesterner, I grew up in Oregon, so just a little south of you, it always kind of irked me that we could never actually hear from parts of the country from shows that originated on the East Coast. So instead of doing calls now, we're reaching out to people directly in places in the country and trying to hear from them. And like I said, bringing experts in to help us sort through the complex world we're living through.
How do we connect? How can Seattle area listeners participate in the conversations?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I want Seattle listeners to send us email. We're at onpoint at WBUR.org. And send us email on the types of stories and issues that matter to you that you want to hear about. I mean, we're already doing shows that I think would be relevant to Seattleites. Like, we're doing this whole series on Amazon, kind of following in the footsteps of the series that KUOW did, that podcast series.
Mm-hmm,
we're going to talk about housing and evictions, which I know, you know, the sharp rise in housing prices in Seattle has been a really big issue for a long time.
Yes.
You know, and we're going to talk in the near future about a kind of a return to a show that we did about Portland, Oregon last year when the federal troops were there. Mm-hmm. We're going to go back and take a look at sort of what life has been like in Portland since then, and a check in on that. So just a little taste, but really just onpoint at WBUR.org. Send us an email. I want your ideas, okay?
Yeah, I relate, Meghna. We're doing the same thing. We're pausing our show, The Record, to reimagine what should our local daily news show be today. And you hosted Radio Boston on your local station, BUR. So what makes for a great local daily show?
Oh, well, first of all, even though I'm hosting a national show right now, being able to be a journalist that serves a local community in Seattle is like the epitome of this, is the greatest job in the world. So what makes a great show? Really connecting with the issues that matter to people in the community, hearing back from them, uncovering the stories that maybe like it's harder to find the truth about anymore because local journalism has been so radically reduced over the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of, you know, knowing your neighbors and listening to them. It's a great combination. And I can't wait for when The Record comes back in an even better form. So keeping the seat warm for you, okay?
Hey, we're going to have a great summer with you. Meghna Chakrabarty, host of WBUR and NPR's On Point, which you're going to be hearing at noon on KUOW starting next week. Meghna, great to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
And we were just talking about what makes a great local show. As I say, while we're off for the summer, we're going to be retooling the show, and we want to know, what do you want out of a KUOW daily local news show? Let us know by filling out our survey, and that is at KUOW.org/record. It's just three questions, and we ask, do you want to talk more with a member of the KUOW team and share more feedback? And you don't have to, but that short survey is going to be found at KUOW.org/record. Thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW, produced by Jenny Cecil Moore, Alec Cowan, Brandy Fullwood, and Sarah Leibovitz. I'm Bill Radke, and let's do Week in Review, as always, tomorrow, right here.